I didn't forget. All right. So a bunch of cool questions today. Let's just jump right in. These are the ones that came in from Marlise. Okay. I often hear you cite Robert Thurman, "It's not safe to die if you still have an unconscious mind." Yes, I do that because I think it's a brilliant statement. I actually asked Bernardo what he thought about this. Very interesting response. I like it, but I also wonder what it exactly implies. Would such a fully conscious, aware being be present despite whatever happens to its physical brain during a surgery in a comatose state or after drug abuse or with dementia? Yeah, good question. Yes, in short, yes. Someone who has made the entire dimension of their unconscious mind conscious. In fact, Jung talked about this as a process of individuation. I talked to Bernardo on Monday about this is one way. I think at a deeper level, post-individuation, you could talk about what it means to be awake. I think that in Western psychological jargon, this is one way to talk about enlightenment, really. There's no such thing as an unconscious mind and an awake being, and then I'll be very specific about your question. This is one reason these people don't sleep, they don't dream, they don't die, because there's nothing left. Sleep is a product of ignorance. Ignorance, and this now I'm talking literal sleep at night, they literally don't sleep. Doesn't mean they're staying up all night playing video games. What an image, right? A 24/7 Buddha playing Pac-Man or whatever. I don't know anything about these games. It dates me, Pac-Man, right? Prehistoric. No, it means that their mind never turns off. They maintain a 24/7 awareness. And literally, they don't sleep, they don't dream. Or another way to say this is literally dreams do cease in a classical sense. There's nothing to see to dream. And Delson Armstrong has this capacity, by the way. He doesn't dream anymore. I totally believe it. Makes complete utter sense. And you'll see when I talk to him, this guy, he's a real deal. He's not jazzing me. And actually what I was gonna say. So yeah, they don't dream in the way we know it. That type of dream completely ends. But another way to say this, really saying the same thing, everything becomes a dream. Everything is seen to be manifestation of mind. Exactly the stuff I talked to Bernardo about. And then they don't die because there's death is also a product of ignorance, marigpa. So death, sleep, dream doesn't apply to a person like this. And so literally during surgery, they don't go out. They literally don't black out. And Rupert Spira shares this story. He had a podcast interview with Sam Harris. You can listen to it. A couple points get super interesting. And Rupert in a somewhat, I wouldn't say, well, I guess it is rare, was talking about how when he had surgery, he didn't black out. And that's not at all uncommon. When you have a deep, deep understanding of the refined dimensions of your previously unconscious mind, you don't go out even under an anesthesia. There's no drug abuse, dementia, all this stuff. Comatose only works with brain states, upper superficial dimensions of your being. The neuroscientific community would categorically dismiss this as bullshit. But that's because they have a very limited myopic understanding of mind. They conflate mind to brain. Brain is correlated to mind. It's not causative. There's a difference between correlation and causation. So everything you're saying seems to imply some type of reductionist. And again, I'm not being critical, Marlise, but there seems to be an implication that you're associating mind with brain. Only gross mind is associated with gross body/brain. But these higher dimensions, it's not. So they don't sleep, they don't dream, they don't die. Drug abuse does nothing. Here's another story, classic. There are many of these. The famous one by Ram Dass giving his guru 25 hits of orange sunshine. Nothing happened, right? People with dementia doesn't apply to these individuals, right? So what it implies is basically, yeah, there's no such thing as an unconscious mind for these people. There's no such thing as death. And so if you want to come on and say a little bit more about that, because it is a really big topic, that's what comes to mind. For us who haven't brought these processes into the light of consciousness, this is what meditation does. This is why Trungpa Rinpoche famously said, meditation is not a sedative, it's a laxative. I love this line. Because all the crap in your unconscious mind has got to come up. But if it comes up in meditation, that's what it does. You become familiar with it, the very definition of meditation. then there literally, there's no such thing as unconsciousness in these types of minds. And you can train yourself to do this. I wouldn't say it's common. It's definitely not common, but it's actually not that uncommon. These people just fly below the radar. They're not out there, the real ones, they're not out there touting their wares. I mean, the most realized people that have this level of mind are the most humble, modest ones. So lots to say, but maybe that's enough. Okay, from Sven, do the stages of dream yoga correspond to the four yogas of Mahamudra? Oh, this is an easy one. No, they don't. The four stages, the four yogas of Mahamudra, one pointedness, simplicity, one taste, non-meditation. It's just one way to classify the four degrees of awareness in the Mahamudra tradition. They do not correspond to my stages in dream yoga. That's an easy one. Okay, here's the one from Tim. Yeah, I'm interested in finding a Buddhist teacher in the Chicago area. I don't live in Chicago, sorry. Do you know any temples, churches, teachers I can recommend? I don't. Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of them out there. You know, my friend Don Morielli wrote a book, actually two editions, Buddhism in America or something like that. I don't know when the last edition, or if there's even a third edition out there. I have the first two. He lists everything. So you might want to ping that book. I think it's literally called Buddhism in America. It's quite a big kind of dictionary of all the centers, probably a little bit outdated. I would guess that there's probably a Theragar community there, but I just don't know, Tim. Sorry, bud. Okay, from Fred. And there's another one from Tim, but I'll come back to that in a second. All right. I repeatedly say to myself, this is a dream. Very good. But do you mean it? Do you really mean it? I mean, I'm just saying, don't flap your lips. Really mean it, right? And maybe if you do, that's great. I repeatedly say to myself, this is a dream. That's part of lucid form practice during the day, trying to imagine my current experiences as a dream. That's good because it is a dream. We just need to understand what dream means here, manifestation of mind. Trust me on this. This here, look around your room. This is just as much a dream as your nighttime dream, guaranteed. But these daylight experiences are bright and vivid. Yes, that's because you're so excessively familiar with them. It's a type of wake centricity, photocentricity, sight centricity, all in the service of egocentricity that through the power of enormous habit, personal habit, culture, society, biology, we think this is real, the nighttime state is not. These experiences are bright and vivid. Yes, they are. My nighttime dreams upon awakening and recalling them always seem darker, not nearly as vivid, and rarely do I perceive color in them. Okay, that's not unusual. Given the difference, it's difficult to sustain the illusion of daytime dreaming and nighttime dreaming being interchangeable. Yes, it is difficult because we're so habituated. I mean, we have all these forces, my languaging, co-conspiratorial forces of the dark side. And for really profound reasons that I also discussed with Bernardo, just this underlying fear. We create a kind of ontological impute, a type of ontological supremacy to the waking state for a ton of reasons. One of which is fear and psychological. And so when we're trying to de-reify this reality, and then another way to talk about what you're mentioning here, Fred, is de-reifying this, in a certain sense, reifying the dream state, that's not an easy thing to do. That's why these yogas are somewhat advanced and they take a lot of effort because we just don't see the world in these completely awakened spaces. So what you're sharing, Fred, is 100% normal. I would say 99.9% of the population would say exactly what you're saying. But that doesn't mean you can't change this, because this is not really the way reality is. Really, trust me, all the wisdom traditions, the non-dual traditions will tell you sleeping, dreaming, dying, it's all a dream. We just need to understand what dream really means. Dream, code language for manifestation of mind. So you just keep going. His Holiness Dalai Lama, what does he say? Never give up. And slowly, 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 if you just keep going at it, Eventually, you will find, actually, as your mind stabilizes, meditation is colossally important here. As your mind stabilizes, becomes more clear, more vibrant, more lucid, and then that mind is released free of sensory constraint in the dream arena, guess what happens? Your dreams become more clear, stable, vibrant, to the point, literally, where you can have hyperlucid dreams. Some of you listening have had these, where those dreams are more real than this. Near-death experiences are like this. When I interviewed Evan Alexander about his now quite famous near-death experience, I mean, his whole thing was a massive hyperlucid experience. And so it's really, it's just a matter of habituation and degree that we reify the state and then, you know, kind of categorically dismiss the ontological equivalence of the nighttime dream. And so the only thing I can tell you, my friend, is what you're sharing is 100% normal, but it's not the way it is. So you just keep at it. You study more about dream yoga. You study the teachings on emptiness. You do the so-called spiritual path. And then eventually, guaranteed, your dream state becomes more and more real. This becomes less real. And eventually you will see the democratic nature of all states, right? Not easy, not easy. Simple to say, not easy to do for so many different reasons. And that's usually why people give up, because this stuff is subtle. So many forces working against them, they just say it's just not worth the effort. And that's fine. But if you really want to wake up in the spiritual sense, this is kind of the only game in town, okay? All right, Joe, what is the difference between open awareness and Dzogchen? Oh, okay, good question, big one. Come to Menla. I'm so cheap, I'll put up my lemonade stand anywhere. This is exactly what we're going to talk about in Menla. But anyway, open awareness, when you talk about Dzogchen, by the way, I'll define both these terms. Dzogchen is arguably the highest, literally means great completion, great perfection teachings. It's the highest branch of teachings in the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And when you say Dzogchen meditation, again, not only are there dozens and dozens of meditations, just like there are dozens of sports. So when people say meditation, let alone Dzogchen, my first question is, what meditation are you talking about? So even Dzogchen, what meditation are you talking about? Sounds to me like you're probably talking about Treksha versus Togal. So there are two main practices in Dzogchen. I bet you're referring to the cutting through to, it's called Kadak Treksha, cutting through to primordial purity, versus Togal, Buddha Togal, which is crossing over to spontaneous presence. So the Dzogchen meditation, usually when people say Dzogchen, they mean Treksha. It's similar to open awareness, but also in a very subtle way, quite different. And so there's so much to say here. Here's the way I work with it. The practice of open awareness, open monitoring in the scientific community, that's the word they use, non-referential shamatha, awareness of awareness, shamatha without a sign, formless shamatha. There's a bunch of different names for this, but I like open awareness. Open awareness is what Dzogchen degenerates into. It's still dualistic. Open awareness, even though it's incredibly refined, It's not non-dualistic. It's still dualistic. It's still very, very subtle duality. And so when Dzogchen samadhi meditation degenerates, it degenerates into open awareness. So therefore, you can use open awareness as a platform into Dzogchen. See, and that's why it's so bloody important. Because if you really get good at the open awareness thing, and this is like my main favorite practice these days to teach. This is a practice that will leave breadcrumbs for you, like Hansel and Gretel. You can find your way back to reality, to Dzogchen, through the practice of open awareness. So they're not the same. Dzogchen is completely non-dual nature of mind. Open awareness isn't. It's still in the realm of Sem versus Rigpa. And so even though they're very intimately connected and the very highest, you know, you can't do hard, cold, steel, categorical distinctions between these, because the very highest bandwidths of open awareness actually bleed in to Treksha, Dzogchen, Mahamudra. And that's the genius of this practice. And so, in fact, this book I'm sending off, I finished it today. I finished this book today. Yay, big pat for me. A book I thought I had 18 months to finish, I finished in 3. And so I'm super excited about this book. And I devote two chapters to the practice of open awareness and its relationship to the full formless meditation. So open awareness is still a very, very, very subtle form. Dzogchen is completely formless, okay? So a difference between sem and rigpa, form and formlessness. Also same person, Joe. Also sometimes, especially right before I wake up, it's a liminal space, probably hypnopompic. There is a state of mind that is without object. Fantastic. Good for you for saying that, right? State of mind is without object, content, or me. It seems totally relaxed and open. High five. That's fantastic. Sometimes it lasts for a while and sometimes a short time. That's normal. How would you label that state of mind? Oh, that's always so tricky, right? So I'll do my best to tell you what I think it is, but here's an interesting story. I think I heard this from Ram Dass, I'm not sure, where God and the devil are walking, taking a walk. What a great image, right? God and the devil are taking a walk together. and God looks down and sees something, whatever, quite beautiful, points it out to the devil, and the devil looks at it, picks it up, and he goes, "This is fantastic. I'm going to name it." Like, what a beautiful story. So it's demonic on one level to label things. Why? Because we tend to reify our labels. We tend to live in the world of maps. And so whenever I always, my little red flags come up, how would you label that state of mind? And I will do my best to label it with this caveat. We always need to know the map is never the territory. And anytime you throw a label on anything, whatever you say it is, it isn't. So Korzybski, the great semanticist, said that. And so what I would label that, if there's truly, Joe, if there's truly an experience of objectlessness, no content, no me, then that's Rigpa. And again, anybody can have this experience. Anybody can. It's just a matter of recognizing it. So if this is in fact the case, and I don't doubt you, and when you wake up in the morning, and this is what's so bloody cool about these hypnagogic, hypnopompic space, the liminal spaces, is this is you're talking about precisely the gift of this dimension of the nocturnal mind, which is why I'm riffing more and more about liminal spaces because of exactly what you're saying here. So high five for you. When you're in the liminal space going into sleep, you can watch the self-sense deconstruct. You can watch the narrative self-sense fall apart as you fall asleep. When you first wake up in the morning, before that narrative self-sense comes back online, there's a gap, there's a bardo. That's before the narrative in the crappy storyline that ends up being you, or I'll speak about self, me. It's not there, the page is still is ripped out. In that dimension, you can totally have an experience of Rigpa, nature, mind, Dzogchen. And so if this is in fact no sense of me, I'm not even having that experience, that's it. Really, that's it. 100% legit. That's very cool. So resting in awareness, awareness of awareness. If there's absolutely no sense that I'm having this experience, that usually comes after the fact. It's a postscript retrofitting. If you're actually feeling exactly what you said, that's Rigpa. Very cool. Okay. All right. From Katie. From Estonia. Oh, how wonderful. Estonia. I've been to Latvia. I've been to Lithuania. My mom was Lithuanian. I used to speak it. It was my second language after Spanish. I learned Spanish when I was in Bogota. I was born in Bogota. Spanish, Lithuanian, English. English was my third language. Lithuanian is actually the closest language to Sanskrit. Isn't that interesting? And so I've not been to this Baltic state, but I've been to Lithuania and Latvia. And so, hello. Labas. So, okay, I wonder if I have understood correctly. In Buddhism, a mind is considered a continuum of mental moments, each moment causally emerging from the previous moment. Okay, so I'm going to run commentary as I go through these because otherwise it's too long for me to just backpedal and restart the whole thing. Kathy, it depends on when you say mind, again, this is important. This is part of the granularity, the articulation, the elegance of these traditions where when you say mind, what are you talking about? Are you talking about SEM? Are you talking about Rigpa? Are you talking about low? So what, when you say mind, what kind of mind are you talking about? To me, based on your question, you're talking about SEM, low. And in this case, yes, in the Abhidharma tradition, and also neuroscience will tell you this, mind, and that's not even mind. I talked to Bernardo about this, I think, I'm not sure, because I talk to a lot of people these days. It's not even mind, it's minds, plural. Because otherwise we think there's a monolithic unifying, it's actually called monism, mind. It's not mind, it's minds, plural. And every moment, as you say here, yes, in a lightning fast out of the zero point energy field, and I did talk to Bernardo about this, mind comes up out of the zero point energy field, that's emptiness, manifesting at lightning speeds through these atoms of experience called dharmas, small d. And exactly what you say is true. It's called santana in the Theravada tradition, stream of mind, which is really more staccato of mind, pixelated, quantized mind. William James coined the term stream of mind, but it's only a stream of mind due to what neuroscientists call flicker fusion. Basically the speed of the mind that freezes these discrete, discontinuous moments of arising. So when you really, really slow down, you discover the quantized, pixelated nature of reality. And that, somewhat connected to the previous question, means not only reality there, but reality here. You realize that you're a Seurat painting, a pointillistic painting, just like the phenomenal world. And the Abhidharma Buddhist psychological tradition talks about this with tremendous elegance. So if you really want to understand this stuff, read the Abhidharma text, of which there are many, many. Glimpses of Abhidharma is my favorite one, by Trungpa Rinpoche, because it's a tantric rendering of the Abhidharma teachings. Also, just thought of this, I spent 2 hours in my second interview with Delson talking exactly about this topic. This was the entire 2 hour conversation, talking about mind moments within the context of dependent origination, Paticca Samuppada. So when that's posted in probably end of next week, we spend 2 hours on this topic. Okay, in Buddhism, a mind is considered a continuum of mental moments. Yes, SEM is, not Rigpa. Each moment causally emerging from the previous moment. Yes, provisionally. And again, this is where it gets really interesting. On a relative level, there is a causal connectivity from one moment to the next, but not so on an ultimate level. And the work of the great Indian philosopher, sage Nagarjuna, basically shows you that even causality is an illusion. So on a relative level, yes, what you're saying at the level of SEM is true. On an absolute level, it's not. The present moment, this is you again, the present moment is born from the death of the last moment's mind, yes, at the Abhidharma Theravada level. Between each moment, there is a gap. Yes, there is. So in that part, correct, there is a gap. Reality is discontinuous, it's parsed. Oh my gosh, there's so much literature here. The other one, if you're a little bit deeper, more academic, sciencey nerd like me, the classic book here is The Embodied Mind. This book almost started the whole cognitive neuroscience movement revolution. Francesco Varela, Evan Thompson, Eleanor Roche. I read this book, the minute it came off the press, it just blew me away. I think MIT Press. So if you really want to study this at a scientific level, that's the book to get, The Embodied Mind. Question number two, how to understand a moment? That's a really good question. I imagine that it does not equal a second. It definitely doesn't, as a Western measurement of time. Does its length depend on the individual? For sure. Is it really possible to perceive even the fading, dying of the previous moment? Yes and no. These are great questions. I love this stuff. So from a Theravadan perspective, yes, you can detect these arising fadings at this highly refined level with a really highly refined mind. And so this is where scientists have studied this. They study mind moments. I'm not entirely sure Francesco Varela was the first one to do this, but he was big into this. And what his studies and others have shown since then, they do this, it's so interesting studies. They have shown, roughly speaking, that the untamed, untrained mind has what's called an intentional blank, or an ability to resolve reality at around 200 to 250 milliseconds. The millisecond is a thousandth of a second. And so in an untamed mind, you see roughly at that frequency, that bandwidth. In a tamed, really trained mind, 10 to 25 to 50, I don't know exactly the numbers, but it's literally a tenfold increase in resolution. And so these people literally, this stuff is not hypothetical. This stuff is the direct experience of people who have these highly refined minds. And they test these things. They put them into what are called tachistoscopes, which are fancy strobe lights, where, you know, depending on the level of the light arising, an untamed mind would see, let's say, I don't know, roughly the resolution frequency for the flicker fusion frequency is usually around 16 to 24 hertz. That's when we create the illusion of not only visual, but auditory continuity. If you slow your mind down, you start to see the breaks in reality, literally. You literally deconstruct reality, and you're able to see at a much more refined level. So what we would see as continuous light, untamed mind, a yogi would see, in fact, your alternating current above you, would see as light flickering on and off. So this lends a lot of credibility to this traditional proclamation that meditation increases awareness. It's not a metaphor, it's true. Meditators hear more, feel more, smell more, taste more, because their awareness is so heightened. And so there are several ways to talk about this thing called moments in time. So just like, these questions are so rich. Just like there is no causality, your first question, there's no time in an absolute arena. So in the realm of the absolute, and this is one way to know when you're in the absolute, there's no space, there's no time, there's no causality. It's complete non-dual experience. The minute you contract away from that into the world of samsara, then time is created. It's not the backstage of reality. Even Einstein said this. I mentioned this. I think you can get it online. Nima Arkani Hamed, Princeton physicist, famous talk: "Space time is doomed." This is from a hardcore theoretical physicist. Space and time are constructs. So science is now even coming to this conclusion. So space, time, causality, these are all constructs. So we come back to the level of relative reality. Is there a thing called irreducible moment? Well, yes and no. Mostly no, try to find it. They try to measure it, try to find it. So this is the way I play with this. This is actually very interesting. Bernardo writes about this too. Which book? He's written about 10. It's either in my two favorite books of his so far, Science Ideated, his most recent one, I think. And then The Idea of the World. These are two jaw-droppingly brilliant books. Not easy, especially The Idea of the World. It's a series of articles that he wrote for scientific academic journals. A bit heavy lifting, but really brilliant. And so I can't remember which book it's in, maybe Science Ideated, where Bernardo, what I'm going to share with you, goes about it in a much more expanded way, basically decimates the notion of time, and that fundamentally there's only the present moment. That's the only thing that even exists. But even there, the present moment is provisional, because even the present moment doesn't exist. And so there's so much to say here, but briefly, here's one way to play with it. That logically, if you really play with this, this may seem like, can it really be this easy to decimate time? Yes, but you have to really engage it. Kempo Kartar said this. So we can all agree there's no future, right? Future doesn't exist yet, right? Raise your hands, you agree? For sure. We all agree the past doesn't exist, right? Past is dead. Future has not been born, past is dead, doesn't exist, right? Raise your hand, yes. Okay, what then is the present moment? The present moment is, this is my languaging, the present moment is an imaginary line drawn between two non-existents. Even the present moment doesn't exist. And Nagarjuna proves this. So on one level, relative level, and it's completely viable when we do our meditations, yes, we come back to the present moment, and that's really the only thing that exists. Bernardo writes about this beautifully in that riff. But even then, the present moment can be taken apart. Even the present moment doesn't exist. And if you're starting to feel a little queasy and a little groundless, that's actually a good thing, because this leads to the topic of emptiness. Time is empty of inherent existence. So this investigation will lead you into a rug pulling effect, where your reality will be pulled out from under your feet. And so what we do in meditation, and I'll probably pause and let this go because there's so much more to say here. We use the present moment provisionally. We come back to body and breath. We come back to our senses. I'm not dissing this at all. It's super important because the present moment, as illusory as it is a heck of a lot more real than the past and the future. So you come back to the present moment, you come back to your senses, because your senses only operate in the present moment. You literally come to your senses. But then eventually you get to the point, and this is exactly the point in the earlier question where open awareness transitions into Dzogchen. So what I'm talking about now is a way to answer the question from earlier. You come back to the present moment, that's still Sem, that's still open awareness, still in a realm of samsara. But eventually you get into that, it's like a conduit, it's like a funnel, a rivet into reality, where eventually the present moment, you come back to your senses, eventually the present moment falls away to reveal what Padmasambhava talked about as the fourth moment, connected to Turiya in Sanskrit, that is beyond past, present, and future. That's why it's called the fourth moment. It's beyond past, present, and future. And Surya Das talks about this very, I like his languaging here, is Buddha standard time. It's brilliant. Buddha standard time, beyond time, before time. Time doesn't exist. So one last thing here, and then maybe that's enough because we could talk about this all day. Does this rhythm of moments and gaps disappear when one awakens? Yes, because time disappears. So when you're fully enlightened, there are no bardos, there's no gaps, there's no time, there's no space. So yes, what you're saying there is true. Great question. These are all good. So there's one more here from Tim. This is a good one too. Okay, another small topic, karma, Lordy. How much negative karma do you gain? I would say accumulate, because you're not gaining anything, but how much negative karma do you gain, accumulate when you kill a bug? It reminds me of that line from, On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando. Remember that great line? She looked at me like I was a bug, right? So I don't know how to answer this, Tim. It depends on, well, let me read the rest of it, because I think you get into this a little bit. Is the intention more important than the act? In this case, yes. This is where to really understand this, my friend. And by the way, karma, everybody talks about it. Only a Buddha knows what karma is. It's, along with emptiness, the most sophisticated, complex topic in all of, not just Buddhism, but Eastern thought. Karma is really complex. So the way to play with this, Tim, a little bit, and I write about this in my book, Preparing to Die, is to understand the four aspects of a fully loaded or fully constituted karma. What is it? What are the four ingredients that makes a karma fully loaded? This is important because it has to do with intentionality behind things like euthanasia, suicide, abortion. So this stuff gets a little bit important, right? So because the topic again is so big, my friend, again, buy my book. I think it's in the section called The Difficult Topics or something like that. There's like 2, 3, 4, 5 pages where I talk about exactly this topic. Meaning, if you kill a spider in your sleep because you rolled over it versus killing a spider consciously out of anger or fear, absolutely positively. If there's no intention involved, then the heaviest ingredient for karma is not there. So the four aspects of a fully constituted karma are the object, the act, the intention, and then the sense of completion. So if you have an intention to do something, you do it, then you rejoice in it. That's as heavy as a karma can be. If you roll over a spider and kill it, there's no karma there? I don't know. I don't think so because there's no intention involved. But I'm a little bit agnostic on this. Ask a Buddha. Spider, maybe you're Spider-Man in your past life here, Tim. What if the spider is known to be deadly? Should you still try to capture it alive and let it go outside? I don't know, man. I mean, really, these questions just kind of stop my mind. Again, I want you to make your own decisions because I'm not going to be responsible for your karmic account, right? If you're going to create a heap of negative karma, don't blame it on me. You got to take responsibility, dude. Read Trolloc Rinpoche's beautiful book. He wrote it, I think it was actually published posthumously before he died. His book, Karma, that's the title, What It Is, Why It Matters, blah, blah, blah. I think there's another subtitle to it. It's probably one of the easiest renderings of the whole process of karma. I might recommend you look at that. Kind of a crazy follow-up question, but are we not killing millions of bugs or parasites and microbes every time you go to the bathroom and flush? Does this build negative karma? Yeah, exactly. This is exactly my thing around this. We are, most of the microbiome in our body is non-human. If we didn't have an internal antibiotic system, i.e. our immune system, that lives on killing that which is not us, we wouldn't be here. So as we're speaking now, you don't have to go to the bathroom for this, Tim. Right now, your body, like 3 trillion chemical reactions per second, something like that, it's crazy. And your body is constantly killing other forms. Does that create karma? I don't think so. But, life lives on life. So these are deep questions, my friend. And again, the minute somebody mentions the word karma, I just kind of go cataleptic because there's so much to say here. And some of these things, I tell you, they're really, really difficult to answer. And so what I heard from an Acharya once, I asked a series of questions like this, and female Acharya said something quite beautiful. She said, you know, the way to work with this is learn as much as you can about this stuff, study the teachings, study the implications, do your homework, and then use your judgment. Do your own thing based on some information. And so that's the way I roll with this. I study as much as I can. Intentionality is huge. If you're just going around stomping on everything, that's not so great. If you're, a mosquito lands on you or a tick and they're carrying Lyme disease or West Nile, like where I live, am I going to lovingly put it a little in a jar and pull it off? No, I'm going to swat the sucker. I'm sorry. I'm going to kill it. And so does that create negative karma? I don't know. But I'm not going to take a risk of getting Lyme disease or West Nile by letting the critter do its thing. So I get really a little bit edgy about these sorts of things. I can't speak with any authority on this. This is just my, I wouldn't say dilettante, but my somewhat informed, but not completely informed interpretation. So whenever these kind of karmic questions come in, that's kind of where I go with them, okay? So let's take a couple live ones, and then I think I have to go to my other little folder to see if I'm missing anything, but I think I got most of the ones that came in.
Perfect, let's see. I'll get Marianne.
Oh, wait, no, I did forget one. Oh, sorry, let me get this one. Sorry. And then we'll turn it from Bianca. Question about the Dharmata, then I'll get yours. When the reaction of aggression is expressed because there's an energetic felt experience from the act of injustice, what would be the best way to tame that felt truth to have more equanimity? God, these are such good questions. It depends, again, it depends on who you ask and what tradition they're speaking from. So a Theravadin would respond differently from a Mahayanist, would respond differently from a Tantric practitioner. If you take what the Dalai Lama says to be true, and again, who knows if it's true, it makes sense to me. Mahayana transcends but includes Hinayana, Theravada. Vajrayana transcends but includes both. Therefore, Vajrayana is the highest school. That also is a somewhat contentious, controversial topic, but it makes sense to me. Just like quantum, linear algebra and calculus is a little bit more advanced than arithmetic algebra. So from a tantric perspective, you don't want to tame that felt truth. Taming it is a more Theravadan approach. I write about this in my book, first book, Power and Pain. I think I have two chapters on what I call the four arts, abandon it, remedy it, transform it, self-liberate it, where I talk about this within that kind of schema. So a Theravadan may want to tame it. A Mahayana would transform it. A Vajrayana would transmute it. So let's just, because it's such a big topic, let's talk about transmutation. What you then do is you take this energy. There's nothing wrong with the energy. To aggress, aggression is very interesting etymologically. The word literally means to step forward. That's all it means. Aggression gets a negative connotation because it's usually associated with violence. But to aggress literally means to step forward, to act. So the key here, because there's so much to say, is transform it, or transmute it, I should say. Use that energy as electricity to have you act properly, born of wisdom and compassion instead of self-referential self-righteousness. So the best way to, I wouldn't say tame it. The best way to transmute, transform it is twofold. First of all, check connected to the other question. Check your motivation. If you feel an energy of aggression, you will almost always feel contraction. This is aggression in the pejorative sense. If you feel that aggression based on contraction, then number one, just don't move, don't act on that, because that will create karma. If you stay with that energy and you transmute it, that energy then transforms into what's called Vajra energy, Vajra family energy. Incredibly clear, articulate, energetic, emotional space that will then allow you to go into the world to work with injustice, to work with everything that's happening in the world, but now from a non-referential point of view, where now you're actually acting as a representative of a reality instead of a representative of yourself. So maybe for the purposes of time, Bianca, in my book, Power and Pain, I have 12 chapters about this kind of thing. This is a really great question. That it's not just aggression. How do you transform all the poisons, the five root poisons, passion, aggression, ignorance, jealousy, pride? How do you transform all those? Because the Buddhas who have these emotions, they have these energies. They're not effectively emotionally whitewashed. They have these emotions, but they don't create karma. They're literally connected to what are called the four karmas. They don't create karma. Aggression and that being like that does not create karma, because it doesn't come from a contracted space. It comes from a spaceless space, a non-referential space of openness. And therefore, these beings, when they act, they step forward, aggress into the world, they're tremendously beneficial, because they're no longer working from this egoic perspective. So this is a really great question. And so that's what comes to mind around that, Bianca. Really good one. I really appreciate that. That's a great one. Not the other ones. They were also great as well. Okay, Marianne, fire away. I'm going to clear these other files here to make sure I got them all. Okay, I'm listening.
Yeah, hi, Andrew.
I can multitask.
That was a great question. That was a great answer. Thank you. I'm so inspired by what you just said. I hope we can all go out into the world like that eventually. I've been reading this book you recommended, Waking Dreaming.
Oh, Evan, what a great book.
Isn't it? It's even a beautiful cover, isn't it?
Evan is a rock star. I really like the guy. Yeah, he's awesome. He's a nightclub interview guest from about a year and a half ago. I interviewed him.
Anyway,
he's awesome. He's awesome.
I'm curious about a couple of things. Can I read a little bit out of the book?
Okay.
A couple of questions about it. Okay. So he quotes Alan Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were in this retreat together, Alan said, "When you're awake, it's always better to be mindful than not mindful. When you dream, it's always better to be lucid than not lucid." Being lucid means not being lucid means being both ignorant, not knowing you're dreaming, and deluded, believing you're awake. When you recognize the dream state in a lucid dream, you replace not knowing with knowing, and delusion with true comprehension. And then Evan said, this way of looking at things, its strong prescriptive or normative placement of lucid dreams above non-lucid ones troubled me. During the question period, I tried to explain why. And so Evan says, non-lucid dreams may have their own value. So we shouldn't think of them as being inferior to what they would be if we were lucid in them.
Right.
There seems to be different kinds of dreams. Dreams where you replay recent memories, what Freud called day residue dreams. And this is the part that really interests me. And dreams with a wholly different quality of clarity and intensity and creative imagination.
Yeah. So let me just say something about that.
Yeah.
I remember that very well from the book.
Yeah.
These are both amazing individuals. I have tremendous respect for both of them. And I think on a certain level, they're both right. And by that, what I mean is that, again, this kind of this narrative of transcend but include. So what Evan is doing, this is just my interpretation. Evan is talking a little bit more from an interpretive psychological relationship to dreams, where it's 100% true. It's absolutely true. And in fact, that's what you're going to be doing on Saturday with your group. Is that
that's part of the reason I brought it up.
I wondered, yeah, the dreams arise. What did Freud say? Something like an uninterpreted dream is like an open letter. Your body is in your unconscious mind, which are the same thing, constantly sending up messages. Not all dreams are messages. This is why it's helpful to understand the spectrum of dreams. Some dreams are not just merely day residue. Some of them are just neurological noise. They're meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other dreams that have this intermediate bandwidth of importance that are psychologically helpful. And that's fantastic, the source of dream interpretation, dream therapy. I have tremendous respect for that. Absolutely viable as a particular bandwidth of relating to the nocturnal mind. However, with that said, I also agree with what Alan is saying, that a higher level is complete awareness of all states. And this is one thing that Evan did not talk about. You can have a lucid relationship to the contents of your mind without interpreting them. So lucidity, therefore, really is the trump. Oh, that's a dangerous word. Lucidity is, I think, a higher form of dreaming, whether it's an overt lucid dream or whether it's a witnessing lucid dream or what Ken Wilber calls telucidity, which is full lucidity in the dream, but without interrupting, without doing anything with it. You're simply watching it. So you're still having exactly what Evan's alluding to. The mind is still doing its creative thing, its interpretive thing, all the stuff is still coming up. But with lucidity, with witnessing awareness dreams, you watch that with full lucidity, and therefore you can almost interpret it on the spot, right? You don't even have to wake up to interpret it. So I think they're both right, but I would say that Alan's view is, and again, this is tricky, I think it's the more evolved, elevated view. It makes more sense to me. But see, why can't you honor both, right? Why can't you have both? On one level, completely viable what Evan is saying, but I think a little bit more viable what Alan is saying. Okay?
And I wonder too that there's another kind of dream that's not lucid and it's not psychological. It's a big dream. It's a transformative dream. Maybe it feels like a dream that came from somewhere else, or a dream that informs me towards my own awakening. That's not psychological.
Absolutely. Exactly. Again, that's another really beautiful intimation of the spectrum of resources, natural resources we have to the dream world. And so the reason to understand things like dream yoga, sleep yoga, and all these other ones is because the psychological traditions don't traffic here at all, and therefore they don't really have a ton to say about it. It may even be somewhat dismissive of it. The thing, again, like Vajrayana associated with the other ones, the same transcend and include narrative, with that higher view, I wouldn't say look down, but you can, again, not in a pejorative sense, but you look down, so to speak, you see all these other dreams playing out, you honor them, you charge them in terms of like integral dreaming. And then you realize, just like with anything else, there are spectrums of skillful means, spectrums of dreams, spectrums of ways of working with it. And so why not work with them all? This is why I love the whole integral approach. So the way to reconcile the Alan Wallace, Evan Thompson thing is an integral approach. That just really speaks to me. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Andrew. Right.
Again, thanks for helping us out on these groups starting on Saturday.
I'm looking forward to it.
Very kind of you. Cool. All right. Shariputra, Prem Das.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Is it Yogacara or Abhidharma or both today?
it's something simpler that I might understand. How's that?
That sounds great.
My question, sir, is in the Nyingma presentation of the nine yanas, I think I have a misunderstanding that these are successive stages that one has to pass through, but maybe that's not the right way to think about it, because like it seems like nobody really talks about, you know, kriya or charya. Or,
they do, you know, but it's just not that or they do.
And like Anu Yoga is like deliberately not talked about. So if you could maybe clarify all that to me.
In 30 seconds or less. I'm laughing with you because your questions are just so good. Yeah, so it's just what you said. So yana means vehicle. There's classically three yanas. If you even subscribe to this view, so like from a Theravadan/Hinayana perspective, they're going to raise their eyebrows to this whole thing. So we have to understand that right off the bat, that not every tradition is going to subscribe to this. So what the Dzogchen tradition does, Nyingma, is it takes basically the three yana approach and expands it into a nine vehicle approach. Now, in terms of like how helpful this is, it depends on your predispositions. It depends on the level of your granularity. Depends on how deep you are as a student, as a tantrika. In that case, and I'm a little bit in that camp, then understanding the whole nine yana thing is extraordinarily helpful. And there, you know, most of the teachings I've received on this, I'm trying to think if there's anything I can refer you to. Most of the teachings I've taken on these come in lectures, transcripts. They're not published. They're if I was to move my camera way over here, all these bound volumes here are all the transcripts, you know, thousands of pages of transcripts that have never been published. And so I can't refer you to these because I don't know how you would get them. But I think these are all completely viable. And there are traditions that there are teachers who talk about all nine vehicles, especially the six inner and outer yogas, the latter six, not the first three, which are more basically those are Hinayana, Mahayana. And so I'm not sure where to go with this just because the topic is so bloody big. You know, most of the emphasis is in the Nyingma tradition is actually on Ati Yoga, you know, the ninth.
So my question then is the six, you know, of the outer and inner yogas, how essential are they as a prerequisite to even doing, you know, nature of mind practice?
That's a really great question. That's, again, it depends on who you ask. In traditional spiritual pedagogical approaches, they're very important because as a classic maxim, the preliminaries are more important than the main practice. And so here's the way I roll with this these days. This is just my riff on this, is that if you really, really want to do Dzogchen properly, then you go. You enter grade school. This is no different from going K through 12. In this case, it's K through 9. You go through them all. Because otherwise, what can happen, and this happens all the time, people, they feel somehow special, they feel exempt, maybe in the West more than the East. I'm going to shoot all the way to the ninth yana. I'm going to study linear algebra, calculus 3, differential equations before I study my arithmetic, right? We all feel we can just shoot to the top of the ninth jhana, and because it does transcend and include all the others, I'm just going to go right to the top. Well, good luck with stability on that. Good luck with recognition there. So this is where it just gets, it depends on your teacher. Some teachers will say that, especially in the West, time is short, life is short. We're just going to go right to the top. We're going to concentrate on Dzogchen. And there's a lot of people who do that, as you know. It's completely viable. I am not dissing it. But what I am saying is come back to that community 20 years, 30 years after the fact, and let's see how they're doing stability-wise. Let's see how they're doing fruitional-wise. So I'm not in any way in a position to judge the efficacy or lack thereof in doing that kind of thing. I can only tell you there's a reason for this pedagogical approach. This is not an academic thing. The nine jhanas were clearly articulated as a way for really serious deep students to go through all nine so that when they finally get to Atti Yoga, preliminaries are more important than the main practice. You get to the main practice and guess what happens? It works. It sticks. You become a Buddha. Otherwise, you're having a little bit of pot shot luck with the ninth jhana. So I this is one of these things, again, this is totally my personal approach. This is just my gig on it. I'm sure somebody else would tell you something different. I personally don't think they are taught enough, but most people in the West don't want to plod through all these sorts of things. You know, they want to go right to the ice cream. They want to go right to the dessert, whatever metaphor you want to use. And then they suffer indigestion, right?
Well, I think part of the problem is also that, you know, kind of the Mahayana approach is kind of it's thought to say that, oh, you know, if it may take 200 or more lifetimes using that kind of approach, while we got the, surefire one shot, lifetime.
And they're true, but then you know, get back to me about stability, right?
Right. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. You can. I mean, it's right here, right now. Under any condition, that's what traction means. Cutting through means seeing through appearances, realizing it's all right here, right now. 100% viable. But then the question is, stability. What are you going to do with that? So to me, again, these things are very viable. And also worth throwing into the mix is always remember that Vajrayana is a subset of the Mahayana. There's only two vehicles fundamentally, Hinayana, Mahayana. Vajrayana, which is the six yogas of the outer and inner, these are skillful means, implementation strategies for the Mahayana. So the Mahayana is it. Vajrayana is a subset of the Mahayana. So even when you're talking about the six outer and inner yogas, this is important. It's still a subset, so to speak, of the Mahayana, which is why we should never forget the compassion, the bodhicitta, all the things that make these higher jhanas work. What did Trungpa Rinpoche say so beautifully? Studying the Vajrayana without Mahayana, without bodhicitta, is like having the most modern house with every conceivable electrical gadget. Again, the nine jhanas, the six jhanas, but no hookup. Nothing works. So that's why even he knew this. That's why you never forget the Hinayana, the narrow vehicle. You never forget the Mahayana, because otherwise, in this narrative of transcending, but include the inner and outer yogas of the higher six, they're not going to work. So that's the other thing that we need to keep in mind is impatient Westerners. And this is what I love about Pema Chodron's teaching, her whole thing. She's soaked in all the tantric teachings, but her great gift in this life is Mahayana, 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 bodhicitta, compassion. I mean, her whole thing is like, we need some retrofitting here. We need to backpedal and really work with compassion, really work with love, really work with kindness, because otherwise these fancy technologies, it's a little bit like going to Silicon Valley and getting bewildered by all the gadgetry and all the sophisticated, the latest app, you know, what is it? iPhone version 10 to the third power, right? You know, I mean, how many iPhones? We want the latest gadget. And so that's one of the slippery aspects of having all these gadgets that we can play with. So anyway, a really great question, my friend. Best I can do with it in short notice.
Okay. No, that's great. I appreciate the emphasis on rigor, because I think that's often missing.
It is, especially in the West. You know, we just want the quick, easy fix. Doesn't seem to work that well. Okay. All right. Maybe one or two more. Keenan, my friend. And if there's somebody out here who wants to say something, I noticed there's some wonderful, serious, senior people, you want to throw in some comments here, more than welcome. Okay, my friend, fire away.
Okay, hi, Andrew. Well, just wanted to engage with you a little bit. When you were talking about the present moment, it just came to me a definition one of my teachers used, which is the present moment is a hole in time.
Oh, that's really nice. Who was it that said that? I like that.
There's Francis Lucille is like Rupert
Spira. Oh, yeah, Spira's. Totally. The Advaita Vedanta.
Yeah.
Big influence on Rupert Spira, who's one of best buds with Bernardo Castro. That's a great line. Thanks for sharing that. I'm pulling aside. I have one of Bernardo's book here. I'm trying to find which of the ones does he. Oh, here it is. Yes, it is. I found it. So in Bernardo's book, Science Ideated, The Fall of Matter and the Contours of the Main Mainstream Scientific Worldview, Part 5 on Physics, Chapter 22, Do We Actually Experience the Flow of Time? You have to read it.
Okay, perfect.
Really, the guy's bloody brilliant. Anyway, that's a good contribution. Thank you for that.
Interestingly, I was just going to say, occurs to me, these days I'm doing some meditations on time. And using the Kashmir Shaiva tradition as the umbrella, nice. There's this whole idea of the 12 Kalis, not an idea, but a whole set of teachings where the Kali is seen as an embodiment of time itself. And through working with these energies, you can have a more stabilized sense of this movement from no time to time.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
So it just occurred to me in reference to the last conversation you were having of this idea of stability and working with the tantric traditions.
Yeah.
In my experience, being in non-duality, Indian non-duality traditions, it seems like it is a little bit masculine in its approach, or a lot, because it totally rejects the tantric aspects of working with the energies, so to speak. The Shakti aspect completely misses at times, at least in Advaita Vedanta.
Yeah, and it's not the same in Buddhism, because in Buddhism, I would argue, the female penetrates the male in Buddhist Tantra. Chandali, the core main practice of the six yogas is wrathful female, wrathful feminine, right? So Hindu and Buddhist Tantra, they're not quite the same on that front. In fact, sleeping, dreaming, dying, it's the feminine that's actually more important than the masculine. But anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, absolutely. I was going to say, in my study of Kashmir Shaivism, that seems to be the actual case, is that the Shakti is supreme, whereas Shiva comes afterwards. But it seems more in the Western hemisphere, in the Western modern teachers, it seems it's the reverse. And that, from my understanding, that could just be a colonial view.
Absolutely.
Of these traditions.
Buddhism after patriarchy. Well, unfortunately, it's not after patriarchy, because patriarchy is alive and well, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, as you know, Keenan, this is ultimate androgyny. We're talking about two sides of the same coin. And unfortunately, this is actually very interesting, that because of culture, because of patriarchal views, that unfortunately there is this kind of patriarchal dominance. And it kind of trickled down bad economics, where it still can affect even spiritual things. And so fundamentally, these Yabhyam approaches, the deities, Shiva, Shakti, Samantabhadra, Samantabhadri, luminosity, emptiness, it's the same thing. It's just same thing, quote unquote, just basically emphases on different aspects of that same thingness. And so unfortunately, the kind of patriarchal echo residue stain is still there. And it's an unfortunate thing. And so good luck with cleaning that one up, right?
Yeah. I had a quick question for you. You mentioned you just finished a book. Is that the book on Parmenides? Okay, cool.
The one I just read. Peter Kingsley's book. A dear friend of mine, Jonathan Brickland, who's quite a fine scholar, recommended this book 3 years ago. I finally got around to reading it. What was it called? In the Dark Places of Wisdom. And I liked it so much, I just bought his other magnum opus. Here it is. I haven't read it yet. This is a 600-page monster. This is his magnum opus, Reality by Peter Kingsley. This guy's really interesting. He's a polymath. He's a really bright guy. What he has to, I'll pause because I can run with that. Maybe that's not where you want to go, but I recommend reading it because just very briefly, what Kingsley does with incredible rigorous research is shows, you know, we whether we know it or not, we basically live in Plato's world fundamentally. Whitehead said it, all of Western philosophy is but a set of footnotes to Plato. It's true. But what people don't know is Plato was monumentally influenced by Parmenides. And Parmenides was a mystic, wholehearted, deep practitioner mystic. And so for a lot of reasons, in one chapter in his book is beautiful, Killing the Father, he talks about how Plato killed Parmenides. And what that means is he killed his teacher because it didn't fit into where Plato wanted to go. And so it basically what it means is the foundations of Western intellectual approaches, logic, rationality, is actually on really shaky footing, that it's actually Parmenides we need to rest on, not Plato. This is no small thing, but I'll drop that because I'm not even sure that's where you want to go. But I was just
curious because there is a quote of Parmenides or a teaching that I've been contemplating for past few years, and it always results in some dream message or something like that. And the teaching is nothing comes out of nothing.
Sounds good.
That's one of the quotes to Parmenides. And the more I contemplate that, it always brings home some kind of message. And I was just curious if this book kind of dives into it and shows anything that surrounds that.
I think this book does, Reality. Not so much the In the Dark Places of Wisdom is kind of an introduction to his work. And it's a good one. But Reality, which again, I just got this in the mail, I haven't read it yet. But my understanding is what you're talking about is in this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll check that one out. So I won't take more time, but I was just going to say earlier when you were talking about karma, I was once, a few months back, I was reading a book on karma and I had a dream. And in this dream, I was in a situation which I was also in the waking state with my family, and I was trying to figure out how did we all get there in this kind of gridlock kind of situation. And in the dream, I would go into this situation and try to resolve it, try to figure it out. And then the message would be, you cannot just handle the fact that there is no cause to anything. And I've just been trying to understand that. I know maybe at this level, we can't understand that there is no cause and effect. But if one was to absorb that teaching, my question would be, how does one then try to find the best way to live life in the world, troubled situations we are in, cause and effect?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is where you always have to, or should, in my opinion, understand and balance relative and absolute truth. Because this is where a lot of the real raging confusion comes from. Because when we're talking about causality, we're talking about space, we're talking about time, we're talking about karma, we cannot deny that. The relative world operates at that level. And if you deny it, which some New Agers and spiritual people do, that is classic spiritual bypassing at best, and nihilism at worst. And so therefore, What did Padmasambhava say? Your view should be as lofty as the skies, but your conduct should be as fine as barley powder, which means you have to join relative and absolute, heaven and earth, non-duality with duality. Otherwise, you fall into a ton of problems. John Wellwood talked about it. He coined the term spiritual bypassing. He also talked about Advaita speak. And I talked about this, listen to the interview I did with Swami Sarvapriyananda. We go after this a little bit. And I'm going to, when I talk to Rupert Spira, who, as you know, right, he's big into this. I'm going to ask him exactly the same question about absolutism. Absolutism is a real problem in the Advaita tradition. And I asked Swami about this, and he completely agreed with me that it's very easy for the pendulum to swing into the absolutistic department. And then you become dismissive. Unity disparages individuality. Non-duality disparages duality. And you get into all these just ridiculous elitist approaches to the spiritual thing, where fundamentally it's complete loss of tantric views, because tantric is what? One of the things that defines tantra is redeeming body, redeeming matter. Where basically, this is my whole book that I just sent out today. Yeah, it always comes back to me, Keenan. You have to remember that. It's all about me. It's really about finding heaven in hell, finding spirit in matter, finding the sacred in the profane. That's real integration. That's real spirituality. And so this whole absolutistic thing in the non-dual Advaita traditions, they can absolutely slip into that, as can Mahamudra, as can Dzogchen, as can Kashmir Shaivism. Anything, you know, it's the near enemy, the shadow side. You can slip into these absolutistic approaches. And those are actually, in one way, they're worse. I mean, what did Nagarjuna say? He said, you know, those who believe in emptiness are deemed incurable. In other words, if you reify even that, that's even worse. So what I would do, if you really, is with your mind as a deep diver, if you haven't read the Mula Majjhima Karikas, the fundamental entrance to the middle way, Nagarjuna, that's mandatory reading. I mean, my teacher, Kempo Rinpoche, requested that his students read that book 10 times. So I think it's called Son of Wisdom, my favorite translation, commentary by Kempo Tsultram Gyamsa Rinpoche and R.A. Goldfield. Highly, highly recommended. With your capacity, I mean, when Carlo Rovelli, the Italian physicist, read this, it just blew him out of the water. Sure. So Nagarjuna, everybody, deep divers in the Buddhist tradition, this is mandatory reading. Mandatory, because he will then decimate causality. And he will talk about all this stuff in an incredibly elegant, sophisticated way. It's like 1,000 years after this guy, and he's still having a massive impact on thinkers, scientists, physicists today. So check him out.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Actually, what you were describing is kind of my own journey of being in the Advaita Vedanta circles and then moving on to Kashmir Shaivism. And actually, to meetings such as yours, because that's where I feel like, these questions are addressed. So thank you for that. And I love your interviews with Eben Alexander and Christopher Bache. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
He's such a sweetheart, such a great guy. Yeah.
It's amazing because I think those interviews highlight something remarkable, that even though they have such a deep dive into those states, they seem to be more enthusiastic about living the human experience, coming back.
Isn't it beautiful? Totally. And that's what I'm really big into now. You know, if you can't find the spiritual and the material, you're going to slip into spiritual bypassing and all these traps. And that's the gift of Tantra. Find the spirit in the matter. And then you'll see there's no difference.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much, Andrew. Just and on a closing note, I am doing a podcast these days. I started like 4 or 5 months ago, inspired by you.
That's
awesome. So at some point I would love, this is my lemonade stand. I would love for you to engage.
Okay. Paint me a note. You know where to find me. We'll do it.
I will do that. Thank you so much.
Nice to see you, my friend.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me see if there's anything else here in the chat column. Otherwise,
there were, I think, two that came through the chat.
Next book for the book study group from Barry. Yeah, maybe Barry. Yeah. The title of the book, where is it? Here it is. Here's my last run through. Here's the title. So this is version 3. So what I do, the way I work, the essence of writing is rewriting. If anybody's a writer out there, you know, that's so true. And so when I write, write, rewrite, 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 and I do this forever in computer form, and then I always print it out in hard copy form. So this is the third version, third hard copy printout. And I go through, you see how marked up it is. But here's the title, Reverse Meditation, How to Use Your Pain and Most Difficult Emotions as a Doorway to Inner Freedom. I feel quite good about this book. I'm actually quite psyched. So yes, Barry, we'll do that as the next book study group, just for you. Oh yeah, and he posts the Nima Arkana Hemed. Listen to that thing, that'll blow your socks off. Okay, when you're fully enlightened, there is no bardo. Correct, there's no gap. There is no what? There is no, okay, I'm not sure what the implication is there. So where is the Buddha now? Oh, Buddha here now. Oh, I love playing with you a little bit. So here's where is Buddha now? Okay, so here, what comes to mind is, some of you have heard me say this before. This connects actually to what Keenan was just saying about the unification of matter and spirit, where no criticism here, but this is a legitimate cartoon somebody sent me. There's a Christian monk all dressed up with a big sign, you know, Christ is coming. And in the background, there's a little Buddhist monk with a tiny little business card. You have to look really close. Very humble. It says, Buddha here now. So where's the Buddha? Right here, right now. You are the Buddha. You just don't know it yet. That's non-lucidity. So you just have to wake up, become lucid, and you will discover you are the Buddha right now. And that's what's going to happen when you finally do wake up. It's like T.S. Eliot, to return as from where you began and see it as if for the first time. You are the Buddha. You just don't know it yet. Is there a link to the dream class? Yes, I think we have it up there, right? Oh yeah, there it is. Here's a link to the page. Francesca, hi, Andrew. From 1 to 10, how likely are you to host a retreat program in Europe in the not too distant future? Yikes. Not too likely. The travel thing is a nightmare now. Have you been paying attention? It's just that I don't have anything in the works, Francesca. So closest thing is the MEMLA program. So some of my European friends, I'm pinging them, say, hey, come to New York. It's better than Colorado. It's closer. But until things settle with the traffic thing and the COVID thing, I'm not too inclined to hop on a plane. I hate to say it. I appreciate the gesture, but probably not too likely. Yes, Pema Chodron's. Oh, she's 86 today. Oh my goodness. Happy birthday, Pema. What a beautiful soul. I think she just did her very last public teaching. I know for sure at Omega last time. I think I'm not entirely sure. Maybe somebody here knows. She may be completely retiring from teaching altogether. But her latest book just recently came out on death and dying. I haven't read it yet. It's got to be good. She's the best. She's just the best. What is the must-read book just mentioned? I don't know. Oh, Peter Kingsley. What was the title of the book? Something in Wisdom and Something Wisdom in Dark Places or something. All right. Did I not form my question in a question submission earlier today? Tracy, we didn't get it. If you're here and want to ask it or write it, we didn't get that one. Everyone that comes in, I kind of remember. So if you're here and want to ask it, fire away. I'll pause a second. Otherwise, we might be done for today. I'm going away next week. Maybe I'll come back. I haven't decided.
Okay, are you there?
Oh, I'm here.
It's Tracy. Hi,
Tracy. Where are you, Tracy? I don't see you.
I'm Pennsylvania driving to the movies. But anyway, so my question was, because I had my first lucid dream, I was so excited. Oh, and when I was up there, when the wind blew me up and I was up there and I didn't come down, I said, oh my God, I said, is this a dream? Oh right. My gosh, I'm having a lucid dream.
Very cool.
Right. And, but anyway, so then I went back down but my dream didn't end. I was so excited to tell somebody about having a lucid dream, and I found somebody in an abandoned fair to tell, who wasn't nearly as excited as me. But is that is that count, or do you have to, or do you wake up after them, or?
Well, it totally counts. Are you kidding? Absolutely. Okay. So celebrate. Okay, cool. That's fantastic. And very often what happens is somewhat similar to what you share. People get so jazzed, so excited, it kind of tends to wake them up. And so what you can do is there's ways to work with that. Briefly look down, engage the dream, participate, and then you'll find you'll be able to stay in the dream longer and longer and longer. But that absolutely totally counts. And, maybe you've cracked the door open and now you can find your way back in, and maybe you'll have these with a little bit more regularity and frequency. So
I have all my tips from your books and all the things I listen to and the other stuff I read. And
cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
Excellent. Yeah. So come back and file some more reports. We love to do those sorts of things.
I will. And I'm coming in September. Vermont.
Okay.
My husband and I.
That sounds like a plan. Look forward to it. Okay, yep. Everybody. So we do this totally geeky thing. If you want, you can turn your camera on. You don't have to, but this big kind of hug fest. I'll be back in probably 2-3 weeks. Oh, yes, almost forgot. We also, if it means anything to you, dedication of merit, everything of, that may be any benefit we did in this last hour and a half, don't keep it for ourselves. We send the merit out for the benefit of all sentient beings, and we try to do some good in this planet. We step forward, aggress in the best sense as a way to benefit. Otherwise, what are we doing here? You know, talking about stuff, we need to act. We need to do things in the world. So until next time, everybody, ciao, ciao. Great to see everybody. So fun. Got to say hi, bye to everybody here. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. I think so. In the meantime, all the best to everybody. So great to see you all. Ciao, ciao.